leads to a certain disposition. So what is very important is the repetition of certain acts, which ultimately or finally leads to a certain disposition. Malaka actually is formed through practice and conscious effort. If the practice and conscious effort are persistent, they will eventually produce a disposition. Let's have a short break, dear brothers and sisters.
My heart, soul, and body, every single day of my life, with every breath, I solemnly promise to try to live my life for you. Oh, Allah, you did revive my soul and shone your light into my heart. So please, you is now my only goal. Oh, I love you so. I love you so.
If you want to, for example, be a pious person, you should have the faculty, you should have the disposition. And that disposition is not created overnight. It comes into existence by and by, and with the passage of time, provided that obviously the person has the determination and the resolve to change himself and to make himself better. You know, man is a free agent. He exercises free will. He has the volition to change himself, because he is not actually living a life led by instincts. No, he is a free agent and he exercises free will. He exercises free will. So man changes his life, his habit and manners by making conscious efforts. When he is making efforts to change himself, he is doing it consciously. He knows in the back of his mind that he is trying to change himself. Sometimes, of course, a man's habit is formed by the environment in which he lives. Because if you put yourself in an environment which is either good or bad, so depending on the environment, sometimes the environment is good, sometimes it's bad. So it is the environment that shapes, of course, your character or the character of a child. Especially a child is more vulnerable and more susceptible to the environment or the setting in which a child lives, whether the environment is created by the family or it is the society that creates the environment. At the end of the day, it is the environment that shapes his character and his personality. Obviously, a person cannot escape the influence of the environment. Whether the environment is good or bad, it will have an impact on your conduct and on your behavior. Now, children and youngsters are more vulnerable. They are susceptible to the influence or to the impact of the environment. And environment has its impact on you willy-nilly, whether you want it or not. So it has its impact. Sometimes you make your own independent and conscious effort to change your life, to better it, to improve it, to live a better life, because you have the capacity to change it. You have the ability to change it. You have been gifted with the power, with the will, with the resolve to change your life, to make it better, to change your personality, and to live a life characterized by ethics, by morality, by goodness, and by moral values, of course.
Before it's too late, too late, too late.
Welcome back. This is For a Better Life from IRIB English Radio. We discussed the hypocrites. When we speak of man's capacity to change his dispositions, we do not mean he should destroy his instincts. We do not mean he should suppress his instincts or his desires. Of course, the desires are there, the instincts are there, and sometimes those instincts can actually overpower the individual. But living a life or changing one's position and the capacity to change one's dispositions, of course, does not mean that we should destroy our instincts. We should, of course, take care of those desires. We should take care of those instincts and make sure at the same time that they do not mislead us, that they do not lead us away from the right path. Because instincts can do this. The instincts, if they spiral out of control, they can actually lead a person out of the right path. It is very much important that one should try to maintain moderation and not to go to extremes, and of course to control his instincts, and of course make at the same time deliberate and conscious efforts to change his life, to create a change, a positive change in his life. The Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family has been reported to have said, "The most complete of believers in Iman, in terms of Iman, are those who are best in character." It has also been reported from Imam Hassan alayhi salatu wassalam, and this is the last hadith with which I would like to conclude this episode. Inna ahsan al-hasan al-khulq al-hasan. The best of good things is good manners. With this, we come to the end of this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land, he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand, he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash, he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share, he knows.
Criminalizing Hamas may please the Israeli regime and the right wing of his party, but it will only further blacken Britain's already dark record as the betrayer of the Palestinian people, says Avi Shalem, writer in an article titled, "Hamas Terror Listing is Yet Another UK Betrayal of the Palestinians." Stay tuned for more. British Home Secretary Priti Patel has declared her intention to proscribe the whole of Hamas, the Islamic resistance movement that rules the Gaza Strip, as a terrorist organization. The military wing of the group was proscribed in the UK back in March 2001. 20 years on, the Home Secretary proposes to extend this ban to the political wing by arguing that the distinction between the two wings is no longer tenable. The truth of the matter is that the distinction was tenable in 2001 and it is still tenable today. What is more, it is a crucial distinction. Patel's announcement came soon after Benny Gantz, the Zionist regime war minister, designated six Palestinian civil society NGO groups as terrorist organizations. This designation came close on the heels of the decision by the International Criminal Court, ICC, to launch a full-scale investigation of alleged war crimes committed in the occupied Palestinian territories. The Zionist regime war minister Benny Gantz was Israel's forces chief of staff during its assault on Gaza in July 2014, in which at least 2,256 Palestinians were martyred, of whom 1,462 were civilians, including 551 children. This makes Gantz a prime suspect in the ICC's war crimes probe. Hamas agreed to cooperate with the ICC investigation, but the Zionist regime refused. Some of the Palestinian organizations placed on the Zionist regime's terrorist list are cooperating with the ICC investigation. Although the evidence produced by the Israeli regime was judged inadequate by the European Union and the US government, the terrorism labor achieved its goal of stigmatizing the NGOs, curbing their ability to raise funds and disrupting their operations. The Zionist regime's move was widely condemned as an attack on human rights. The British Home Secretary was not among the protesters. Patel shares with UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson a Manichean view of the West Asia region struggle, in which the Zionist regime represents the forces of light and Palestinian Hamas the forces of darkness. The reality is slightly more complicated. Reactions to Patel's announcement were predictably polarized. A Hamas official said that it showed absolute bias towards the Israeli regime occupation and is a submission to Israeli regime blackmail and dictations. He accused the UK of supporting the aggressors at the expense of the victims. The Board of Deputies of British Jews warmly welcomed the move. In the Israeli regime media, the British decision was hailed as a triumph for the Zionist regime's diplomacy. At a deeper level, the shift in British policy was a product of the close ties between the fake regime of Israel and the Conservative Party. The fake regime of Israel and its powerful lobby had been pressing the British government on this issue for some time. Prime Minister Naftali Bennett urged Boris Johnson to outlaw the whole of Hamas when he met with him last month at the UN climate conference in Glasgow. Patel needed no prompting to do the Zionist regime's bidding. In 2017, as Secretary of State for International Development, Patel went on a freelance trip to the occupied territories without informing then Prime Minister Theresa May or Boris Johnson, then Foreign Secretary. While pretending to be on a private holiday, Patel held a series of secret meetings with high-ranking Zionist regime officials, including the then Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Lord Polak, president of the Conservative Friends of Israel, personally arranged 12 of these meetings. Upon her return, Patel asked her officials to explore the possibility of diverting some of the foreign aid budget to enable the Zionist regime army to carry out humanitarian work in the occupied Golan Heights. She was forced to resign, and she accepted her actions fell below the high standards that are expected of a Secretary of State. Close contact with Zionist regime officials and lobbyists for Israel in the UK, as well as her own right-wing worldview, left Patel eager to swallow Zionist regime's narrative about Hamas. This narrative is utterly distorted and blatantly self-serving. Here, however, are some of the relevant facts. Thank you. True friends do not indulge their friends' addiction, but try to win them from it. Boris Johnson could hardly be more indulgent. His partisanship extends to resisting all international attempts to call the Israeli regime to account for its acts of aggression and unlawful behavior. He is opposed, for example, to the International Criminal Court investigation into war crimes in the occupied Palestinian territories committed by the fake regime of Israel. In a letter to the Conservative Friends of Israel, he said that while his government had respect for the independence of the court, it opposed this particular inquiry. This investigation gives the impression of being a partial and prejudicial attack on a friend and ally of the UK's, he wrote. The perverse logic of the statement is that being a friend and ally of the UK places the Israeli regime above international law. One final question. Why was the latest anti-Palestinian policy shift announced by the Home Secretary rather than the Foreign Secretary? Pater claims that designating the whole of Hamas as a terrorist organization should be seen through a domestic prism. It will help to protect Jews in this country. This is preposterous. Hamas exercises its right under international law to resist the Israeli regime occupation, the most prolonged and brutal military occupation of modern times. Fear-mongering and criminalizing the political wing of Hamas will not make British Jews any safer. In May, in a massively disproportionate use of force, the fake regime of Israel carried out an aerial bombardment of Gaza that resulted in the death of 256 Palestinians, including 66 children. The Community Security Trust, a charity concerned with the safety and security of Jews in the UK, recorded a horrific surge in racist attacks during that month, which surpassed anything we have seen before. If the British government genuinely wanted to make Jews in this country feel safer, it should stop blaming the Palestinian victims for their own misfortune. It should urge its Israeli ally to respect international humanitarian law, to observe ceasefire agreements, to exercise restraint in the use of military force, and to talk to the political leadership of Hamas. Patel's latest move only serves to expose the utter bankruptcy of the Conservative government's policy toward Israel-Palestine. The government claims to support a two-state solution to the conflict, yet, despite the repeated parliamentary votes in favor of recognizing Palestine, the government refuses to budge. When he was Foreign Secretary, Boris Johnson told the House of Commons that the Conservative government would recognize Palestine when the time was right. But the government he now heads, the time will never be right. Timing is just an excuse to procrastinate while continuing to appease the Zionist regime. To be sure, British recognition of Palestine would not redress the huge asymmetry of power between the two parties, but it would give the Palestinians parity of esteem. This is the least that Britain can do for the Palestinians today, given its long series of betrayals stretching back to the Balfour Declaration over a century ago. In his 2014 book, The Churchill Factor, Johnson wrote that the Balfour Declaration was bizarre, a tragically incoherent document and an exquisite piece of F.O. Fujerma. Today, from his position of power, Johnson has a unique opportunity to rectify an egregious historical wrong. Criminalizing Hamas may please the Zionist regime and the right wing of his party, but it will only further blacken Britain's already dark record as the betrayer of the Palestinian people.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, chastity. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of chastity in the Islamic lifestyle. Now, we know that in the Islamic lifestyle, chastity is one of the most important parts of this lifestyle. And we all must have this chastity, this haya or ifaf, which is used in the Islamic texts, in the Arabic texts. This is very important. That a person who is believer, he must have the chastity in his life. And there are many prayers in which we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala from the same thing. We ask, for example, we say, Allahumma zayyini fihi bis-sitri wal-afaf, that, oh Allah, please give me the chastity and decorate my life with the chastity. And this is very, very important that a person who believes that he is the believer and he is the true believer, he must have this chastity in his life. Now, this chastity is not only for the women, it's also for the men. There is a chastity for men and women both. So we cannot say that chastity is for women. No, it's for the men as well. And this is very important that we follow this thing and we have this chastity in our life. Therefore, in order to have chastity, there are a couple of things which we need to know. The first thing in chastity is modesty. If a person has the modesty, he will definitely have the chastity as well. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of chastity, and we said that modesty is one of the basic parts of this chastity, that a person must have this modesty in his life, haya in his life, and this chastity should be, you know, it should be in the clothing, in the, we can say, like when he's talking to someone, when he is looking at someone, when he is communicating to someone. You know, this is very important that when you're in a society, how you should live this modesty. It is not only for the men, it's also for the women as well. And on the other side, like, it's not only for the women, it's for the men as well. Therefore, you know, in the society, in the Islamic society, a lady must cover herself. A lady must cover herself when she is in the public. And when she goes out, she must cover. She should not wear such a clothes which will make people attracting towards her. For example, way of, you know, stepping on the floor, or the shoes, selection of the shoes, selection of the clothes. Similarly, a man should also have this modesty, that when he's talking to someone who is non-mahram, when he's talking to someone, he must also have this modesty in his eyes, in his way of talking, in his thinking and thoughts. And we need to be very much careful when we are outside there, because this first important thing within chastity, which is modesty, it should be seen in everyone, so that when they socialize among the people and when they're socializing, they do make sure that they're living with the modesty and they have this chastity, inshallah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In recent months, robberies have been more visible in the United States, with several involving large groups rushing into stores and coming out with armloads of goods. The article you're about to hear has been written by New York Times journalists Michael Corkery, Sapna Maheshwari, and Jim Tankersley. The piece is titled, "Thefts, always an issue for retailers, become more brazen." Stay with us for more. Flash mobs swarmed through a Nordstrom in Northern California and two Best Buy stores in Minnesota, running out with armfuls of merchandise. Five thieves steal $20,000 in products from an Ulta Beauty store in Pennsylvania in just 40 seconds. A security guard is fatally shot in Oakland, California, while working with a local television news crew, reporting about a recent retail robbery by a group of thieves. Theft is an ever-present issue for retailers in the United States. As much as $68.9 billion of products were stolen from retailers in 2019, according to one industry group. But it has become more visible, more brazen and violent in recent months, forcing an industry already buffeted by pandemic lockdowns and fights over mask requirements to deal with a new problem. This level of violence has taken it to a whole new level, says Rachel Michelin, president of the California Retailers Association. No one has seen this before. Luxury retailers in Union Square in San Francisco, the site of several high-profile robberies this year, have boarded up windows to prevent more mayhem. Best Buy warned last week that theft was lowering profit margins, and said it was using QR codes for checkout in some areas so employees did not need to unlock items right away. Home Depot has hardened its stores, putting power tools and other valuables out of reach, and advising employees not to film robberies with their mobile phones because it could escalate the situation. It has become second nature to take out your phone and record something when it is happening, said Scott Glenn, vice president of asset protection at Home Depot, but these people are getting violent. Retail executives and security experts link the thefts to a confluence of factors, but primarily the ease with which thieves have been able to resell stolen goods on internet in places in websites like Amazon and Facebook. But even industry veterans who have been tracking generations of shoplifters have been stunned by the methods and mindset of the thieves, saying they reflect a sense of impunity. Some recent robberies in which large groups rush into a store overwhelm employees and flee in cars before the police can respond. Recall the looting that occurred across the country amid protests after the murder of George Floyd in May of 2020. At that time, people took advantage of police departments stretched by the protests and ransacked hundreds of stores, including the Macy's in Herald Square, and many smaller retailers, causing millions of dollars worth of damage. As tensions flared across the nation, major retailers like Nordstrom and Target would not discuss the extent of damage to their stores or how many they had to close during protests, instead focusing on their empathy for the demonstrators. The designer, Marc Jacobs, wrote on Instagram, "Never let them convince you that broken glass or property is violence. Property can be replaced, human lives cannot." With the unrest subsided, retailers are less reluctant to talk publicly about theft. Looting in general started during civil unrest, and it has now evolved, said Ben Duggan, president of the Coalition of Law Enforcement and Retail, a trade group focused on crime at retailers. Criminal organizations saw during civil unrest that they were able to get their hands on millions of dollars of stolen products very quickly. The rise in thefts comes as punishments for retail theft have been broadly eased over the past decade. Since 2005, 30 states have increased the dollar threshold for theft offenses, which effectively means that fewer people are going to jail for smaller thefts, according to the National Conference of State Legislatures. More than half of the states now have a felony theft threshold of $1,000 or more. The theft laws were changed to help reduce incarceration rates across the country, and some studies have found that the lower penalties have not led to more crime. And many of the most brazen crimes committed around Thanksgiving far exceeded the $1,000 threshold. Still, the thefts are being politicized, with some leaders saying they show the failure of decriminalization efforts. Others worry that the recent crimes could be used as a pretext to ratchet up penalties and incarceration rates again. Some industry experts say the problem is not necessarily the laws, but the lack of enforcement by the police and prosecutors, which emboldens enterprising thieves. A big priority, they say, should be breaking up the criminal organizations directing and profiting the most from the thefts. Ms. Michener, the head of the California Retail Trade Group, has been meeting with local prosecutors and the governor's office, which has established a task force on organized retail crime, trying to raise the urgency of prosecuting these cases. "The level of organized retail theft we are seeing today is simply unacceptable," California's Governor Gavin Newsom said in a statement. He added, "Businesses and customers should feel safe when doing their holiday shopping." Speaking to reporters on Friday, 3rd of December, Jen Psaki, the White House press secretary, said federal law enforcement officials had been in contact with jurisdictions where we have seen this high level of retail theft. She added that the FBI was working with a task force led by the Los Angeles Police Department and that the Justice Department was providing money to hire 50 additional police officers in San Francisco, California. Both the cities of Los Angeles and San Francisco have experienced high-profile retail robberies in recent weeks. Mr. Duggan, who has worked with a slew of major retailers and pharmacy chains like Walgreens, said that often the people snatching items are paid small fees like $500 for each robbery, which then feed larger enterprises that resell the goods online. Typically, these robberies don't involve large groups looting stores, but instead are smaller thefts that build up over time. one recent case, a 70-year-old man in Atlanta, Georgia, paid recovering drug addicts to steal razors and health products from stores like Target, CVS, and Publix, and take them to his warehouse, according to court documents. The man, Robert Whitley, then sold the items online through businesses called Closeout Express and Essential Daily Discounts. He sold more than 140,000 items on Amazon's marketplace, totaling $3.5 million, according to federal prosecutors. Robert Whitley's lawyer said the thefts never involved violence. He said Mr. Whitley, who had struggled with drug addiction himself, ran support groups and provided shelter for others struggling with substance abuse. Robert Whitley, who pleaded guilty to one count of interstate transportation of stolen property, was sentenced in October to nearly 6 years in federal prison. His daughter, Nonnie Whitley, who was accused of being part of the illegal operation, was sentenced to 5 years imprisonment. Similar cases have occurred from Katy, Texas to Charlotte, North Carolina, and help explain why in many big box chains and drug stores around the country, items like teeth whitening strips and razor blades are increasingly being put behind lock and key. Stolen goods used to show up at flea markets and pawn shops, but that has changed in recent years. One of the biggest issues that brick-and-mortar retailers have been grappling with is the rapid growth of online marketplaces, where anyone can easily sell goods, often anonymously. Amazon, eBay, Facebook Marketplace, OfferUp, Etsy, all of those are utilized by illicit online sellers, and they're allowed to get away with it because the illicit sellers are allowed to operate with anonymity on the internet, Mr. Duggan said. They don't have to list their real name or real addresses or location or their real banking information, so no one is concerned about being caught if they're not even using their real name. Consumers are often unaware of the provenance of items they're buying, but issues can emerge with products like baby formula, which can be expired or otherwise compromised when stolen. The anonymity reflects yet another instance in which criminals stymied by rules in the physical world can operate freely on the internet, an issue that has surfaced in problems involving misinformation, questionable advertisements, and merchandise glorifying crimes. Pawn shops, for example, are regulated in almost every state, said Richard Rossman, a sergeant with the Broward County Sheriff's Office in Florida, who is also part of the Coalition of Law Enforcement and Retail. The Coalition of Law Enforcement and Retail has gotten support from industry groups and retailers, including pharmacy chains Home Depot and Ulta Beauty, on partisan legislation known as the Informed Consumers Act. The bill would require online marketplaces to authenticate the identity of high-volume third-party sellers, including their bank account information and tax identification, and allow consumers to see basic identification and contact information for those sellers. Etsy, OfferUp, and eBay said they support the legislation after opposing a draft of the legislation that raised privacy and safety concerns for sellers. Meta said that Facebook Marketplace users could report items they thought were stolen and that law enforcement could contact the company regarding suspicious items. Amazon said in a statement that we regularly request invoices, purchase orders, and other proofs of sourcing when we have concerns about how a seller may have obtained particular products that they want to sell. Amazon added that it employed 10,000 people working to prevent fraud and abuse on its site and supported the Informed Consumers Act.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The role of outstanding people in helping the country reach the front lines of global science. This is a part of the speech delivered on November 17, 2021, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with a number of the academic elite and top scientific talents of the country. Another point about the academic elite is that scientific personalities, as our discussion is about scientific personalities, must look to the future, the horizon drawn for science in the country, and pay attention to this. I have said before that we should move in such a way that in a reasonable period of time, a few years ago, I spoke of 50 years, Iran will be a source of science in the world. In other words, if people want to know about the latest scientific findings, they will have to learn Farsi. This is possible to happen in the future. You should not be surprised at this. It was like this one day in the world. Once, at a point in history, our scientists were at the pinnacle of knowledge in the world. Their books received careful attention and were cited in all the universities of the world. In the universities of the West and the East, India, China and the like, which were also centers of knowledge at that time. We must look to this horizon.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
A depiction of the stages for reaching the pinnacle of science in the world. Of course, there are certain stages needed for this. The first stage is to bridge the gap between us and other countries in terms of science. We have a large gap to fill. Of course, we admire the scientific progress we have made as our statistics, which are based on global statistics, prove. This scientific progress is commendable and we have truly made progress. However, we are far from being on the front lines of science in the world, and this is due to the fact that they have kept us behind for 200 years. After the victory of the revolution, a movement took place, and starting about two decades ago, a faster movement began. We have made good progress, but we are still a long way off. The first step is to fill this gap. The second step is to progress past the borders of world knowledge. In other words, we should be able to offer new scientific aids and new scientific discoveries to the world. I will expand on this later, and the next step after this is to pursue a new Islamic civilization.
Of Jalali Tehran.
Rubashavit Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The President of the Shura Council and the Deputy Speaker of the House of Representatives in the Saudi-backed Hadi regime admitted that the regime has turned its back to Yemeni people and accused the Saudi-Libyan coalition of causing a humanitarian crisis for the whole nation.
The statements by the officials in the Hadi regime clearly show that the war is not the solution to the current problem in Yemen and the country needs a political solution. The statements also reveal the constructive role of the Ansarullah group in the fight against the Saudi-led coalition. There is a growing public call for an end to the war in Yemen.
The Deputy Minister of Information in Sana'a, Nasruddin Amir, said these statements came in the right direction and Sana'a encourages taking such stances against the Saudi-led coalition, even if they do not have a direct impact on the battle.
We welcome any protests within the Saudi-led coalition. These protests show the true nature of the coalition and come in the right direction. We know that this is the U.S. who is leading the war on Yemen.
Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war on Yemen on March 2015 to return their protege, exiled former President Abdurrabbu Mansur Hadi, to power. The war has killed tens of thousands of civilians, most of them women and children, and pushed the country to the brink of famine.
For 7 years now, Saudi Arabia has failed to achieve any of its announced goals in the beginning of the war. Observers say Riyadh should start looking for other means, including a political solution, to get rid of the quagmire it's stuck with its war on Yemen, since the Yemeni army has proven that it is now a real threat to the kingdom more than ever. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
As the winter draws near, relief materials starts pouring in for destitute Rohingya refugees in India. But urge for schooling and educational material for their children is their biggest worry. Despite the UN conventions on the rights of child, irrespective of nationality, faith or ethnicity, the majority of Rohingya children continue to be deprived of any formal education, therefore threatening their future.
We have faced all the odds and miseries of this world, but we appeal to the world community not to ignore our generations and do everything possible to help us educate our children.
Several thousand Rohingya Muslims have been camping in parts of India for more than a decade with nothing more to share rather than horror tales of violent past. In almost all refugee camps, children would usually be seen spending time in dirt and filth, raising fears of disease and infections across the camps. Nevertheless, nobody cares, including them. This man says anxiously, "We will fight with life as long as we can, but the future worry of our children might kill us silently."
We have been living here in peace since the last 9 years, never faced any troubles. But now things look very challenging. India gave us hope of new life. We want to stay alive for our children, lest we have no hope left.
Regardless of refugee crisis the world has witnessed since last decade, this particular community continues to be unseen victims of violence, yet ignored or perhaps abandoned. Estimates suggest more than 40,000 Rohingya refugees live in India, after fleeing a brutal crackdown in Myanmar. The UN refugee agency responsible to support them is of insignificant help, they say. Rights activists have time and again appealed to the Indian government to lend all possible support to the community, despite the fact they face threat to life back in Myanmar. Minority Rohingya Muslims have for decades fled to neighboring Bangladesh, but it never endorsed any framework to safeguard the interests of these refugees. Now calls are growing for concrete refugee policy, irrespective of political agenda, faith or ethnicity.
U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin met with South Korean Minister of Defense Suk Thursday. The two counterparts agreed to develop new operational plans to deal with what Austin described as North Korea's destabilizing behavior.
The United States and the ROK remain committed to a diplomatic approach to the DPRK, and we continue to call upon the DPRK to engage in dialogue. But we also discuss measures to enhance our combined deterrence posture and to defend against the full range of threats.
Missile and nuclear programs. South Korea wants to see sanctions suspended and an official declaration to end the Korean War. Two items apparently not near the top of the military chief's agenda. Meanwhile, outside South Korea's Ministry of National Defense, activists called for Seoul to disentangle itself from an alliance with the U.S. and take control of its own national defense.
South Korean armed forces and military resources are likely to be dragged into U.S. Indo-Pacific strategies. We came here to denounce it and to deliver this message to the American authorities. The U.S. should return wartime operational control immediately.
Austin also called out China over its military buildup, as Washington now plans to move more forces, an attack helicopter squadron, and an artillery division headquarters to be stationed in South Korea. The meeting here between the leaders of the U.S. and the South Korean militaries comes following the release of the Pentagon's 2021 Global Posture Review. The U.S. will now place even more emphasis on deterring China and North Korea, with Washington calling for more help from its allies. Frank Smith, Seoul.
In draft documents presented to the signatories of the nuclear agreement, Iran is calling for the removal of all U.S. sanctions that violate the deal signed in 2015, known officially as the JCPOA. Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister and lead negotiator Ali Bagheri-Kani says the Iranian draft includes calls for the removal of all sanctions, especially those imposed under former President Donald Trump, as part of the U.S. maximum pressure campaign.
One of the fundamental issues is that no sanctions that violate the agreements, including those imposed under the Obama, Trump or Biden administrations, should stay. They're not acceptable. Some of this hadn't been considered in the previous draft. We've included our modifications.
Iran has called for the verifiable removal of sanctions and guarantees that the U.S. will not commit further violations. Tehran says the ball is now in the U.S. court.
I think this is beginning to sink in for the Europeans and the Americans, that this administration, the Iranian administration, will abide by the JCPOA, but it will not allow the Americans to get additional concessions. It will not allow the Europeans to get additional concessions. Iran did not appease Trump. It's not going to appease Biden.
Following talks with EU coordinator Enrique Mora on Thursday, Bagheri also met the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Mariano Grossi, expressing Iran's intention to continue its close cooperation with the agency and to remain actively engaged in the Vienna talks.
Iran's lead negotiator says he's warned other participants not to allow outside players to negatively influence or obstruct the process of talks, saying his team is serious about reaching an agreement and is ready to continue negotiations. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
Besides financial crisis and political instability, Afghanistan is experiencing one of the worst droughts of the last three decades, further pushing the country into hunger and famine. According to the UN bodies, 80% of Afghans' livelihoods are tied to agriculture, which is now extremely hit by water scarcity and climate change.
This year, we faced a severe drought. Farming costs too much for us. The Taliban have deteriorated our situation by adopting certain policies. They receive 5% of our harvest, or a fraction of our income.
I am 84 years old, and over the past 15 years, I have been experiencing a severe drought in my hometown. Farmers are dealing with water scarcity. We used to have 4 water springs, but today they are all dried up. Meanwhile, we don't have the required facilities to dig deep wells. So, what should we do? Most of us have left our farms, migrating to neighboring countries.
We are suffering from water scarcity. As you see, we don't have anything to harvest this year because of the drought. We hope that the new government and the international community help us amid the current harsh conditions, because we don't have anything to eat.
The Taliban said they are exploring ways to deal with the drought crisis in the country, awaiting help from the international bodies.
There are many farmlands and gardens with most of them left uncultivated because there is no water in wells and rivers. Anyway, we have some plans to overcome the problem. We rely on the international support.
Afghanistan's economy had been rapidly declining since the U.S. seized nearly $10 billion in assets of the Afghan Central Bank. Severe drought combined with aid cut has contributed to pushing millions of Afghans to the brink of starvation.
Here is a remote area in Kabul. Farmers here used to cultivate and grow livestock, but now due to drought, either they're fleeing the country or are struggling with acute hunger and poverty. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kalakon District.
As Yemenis celebrate Independence Day, the Aden Youth Movement called for an uprising against the presence of the Saudi-led coalition's forces and those affiliated with the Hadi regime in the occupied city in southern Yemen.
There is a growing public call for the withdrawal of the invaders from the southern governance because their presence has deteriorated the ordinary people's living condition and the invaders are in full control of the country's oil and mineral wealth. Today, an awakening movement is coming into force, which is against the foreign presence. The movement reminds us of what our ancestors did when they expelled the British occupiers from southern Yemen in 1967.
The movement denounced the deteriorating living condition caused by the continued collapse of the local currency. The U.S. dollar's price has exceeded 1,600 riyals in the occupied areas, compared to 600 riyals in the liberated ones.
The public call for foreign forces withdrawal is completely legitimate because their presence has already led to the current deteriorating condition. It goes without saying that the U.S. and the Saudi-led coalition are the ones who bear the responsibility for these repercussions.
The devaluation of the local currency in the areas controlled by the Saudi-led coalition forces has led to a surge in the prices of basic commodities such as food and medicine. This has hampered daily life for people who are suffering from long years of war.
The depreciation of the local currency and the widespread poverty within the occupied southern areas has contributed to the growing public calls for the foreign forces withdrawal. People here in liberated areas believe that an armed struggle against the invaders is the only way out.